Okay, now since we skipped our middle segment, joining us now will be Helen Ward. I see her hanging out in the wings there.
Yeah.
Come on in.
Come on in, Helen.
Helen is no stranger to the Roadkill Radio audience.
Good evening.
Nice to have you in our studio once again, Helen Ward.
Good evening. Snuggle up to the microphone there.
Have you met Ron Gray before?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
Hi, Helen.
Now, Helen, I want you to talk a little bit in our opening segment here, and I have to clear my brain because it's running a million miles an hour over the last segment and the last guest caller that we had. Information I'm sure you found interesting, too, because you deal with this more on an education front, but, of course, it all factors into the schools. But you're very busy. You're president of Kids First, and you guys are vigilant in watching what happens and transpires within the education system and the political system as it affects families. So there's no end to the work, I guess, on your front.
Well, we can't do it all, so we just bite off what we can chew and don't quite get to that either.
And there's probably a big pile to pick from,
yes,
is there?
Yes, there is.
Okay, back to school. It must be an exciting time for all your members. I mean, the schools are so safe and wonderful, and they're so respectful of parents and the family unit. So there's probably very little work that needs to be done on this front.
Well, yes and no.
Yeah, I'm going to get you to lift your mic up. And then,
is that okay?
One of our handy roadkill techs will just rescue you there. So
there
you don't have to be bending over.
Is that better?
But he's going to have to convince it to stay there. But he has his ways. I'm sure he does.
Well, one thing that whatever parents are thinking about and experiencing with the whole back-to-school thing is, like, just generally you'll hear more and more mutterings of people, you know, aren't happy with whatever it is about school. There's more conflict between parents and schools than there ever has been over a huge variety of issues, not all the same issues for all parents. And that's part of the broader situation of there's more conflict between parents and the state.
Yeah. Now, but why is that? One would think that the public education system is there to serve the needs of the family, to serve the needs of the children, to respect family. I mean, let's face it, without the moms and dads, there would be no kids in the system.
Well, yeah, parents might like to think that, you know, school is about the kids. But that's, you know, it is partly about the kids, and certainly for some, you know, many parents or teachers and staff, it is. But that's not the big picture. The big picture is that school is about also about economic interests. You mentioned that about selling things to kids, about making kids believe things that their parents may or may not be happy that they're believing, about, you know, advertising, about jobs for teachers, jobs for staff. You know,
is it become sort of an industry of special interest? And this is what I'm beginning to look at, because all of these things that we talk about are being funneled and facilitated through the public education system. And I remind our viewers again of my letter that when Lawrence Cannon, no longer our foreign affairs minister, you know, signed a report that fortunately most of the rest of the world was smart enough to know wasn't a good one, about mandatory sex education throughout all the grades. You know, my whole twist on this was, wait a minute, you know, since when did the public education system become a marketing tool or agent for the pharmaceutical companies? Because the more kids you get sexually active, the more birth control pills, the more drugs for sexually transmitted diseases, the more drugs you need for abortions. It's just, you know, a heyday for Merck, right?
Schools, part of the problem is that this infinitely expanding definition of education and schools taking on more and more and more roles.
And they do take it on. You know, I'm listening to some of these negotiations with teachers. Oh, we're expected this, we're expected to do that. I have no expectation of them to be glorified babysitters. I have no expectation of them to be my child's soulmate and confidant and all the rest of it. Those are rules that they're willingly embracing and taking on. So forget all the complaining. I mean, why don't they learn to just say no?
Well, yeah, part of it is, you know, they keep saying, you know, parents aren't doing this, parents aren't doing that. Schools need to teach the whole child. Well, schools don't need to teach the whole child. You know, they need to acknowledge that, yes, there is a whole child there, and we're focusing on this. Like, for example, I teach singing sometimes to kids in grade school, and when I'm teaching them, I'm focused on their musical ability and broad range of musical skills and their voices and stuff like that. And I'm aware that there's a whole child there, but I'm at that point and I treat them with respect and all that kind of thing. But I'm not there to help them in PE, help them in math, and help them with their social skills and help them grow up in all this broader range. I mean, in a focused sense, I am. I also do tutoring, and you touch on a lot of areas, but you got this certain focus.
Right.
And when schools try to take it on, and the parents start to, they get convinced after years of propaganda that the schools are supposed to do everything.
Yeah.
Then the school can't, and it misses the core agenda of just basic academic skills. That's falling dramatically, and they're not able to do all. I mean, the state and the school cannot do those things. Even if the best teacher, the most sincere, caring person, cannot be your student's step in mother, except for a very few times in a day or year, because they're not there. They don't have the long term relationship. They could move. You could move. Come June 25th or whatever it is, school's over for the summer. You might not ever see that person again. So they're taking on roles, and that's not just the schools, it's the social workers and everybody else, that they cannot fulfill even with the most sincere intent. I mean, you can be very good to a child while they're under your watch, but taking on roles that you can't fulfill is a lie.
Surely this is the core problem of government education, because the natural tendency of any government agency is to grow, is to take on more, because their survival depends on expanding their range of activity.
Well, and I think you've hit an important point there, Ron, but the school keeps trying. I mean, hopefully they expand into areas that they're good at, and I can't think of one area that we're excelling in as far as the public education system goes now, except maybe what you started off this discussion with, Helen, in the parent-teacher-state conflict, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I sense that there is a bit of a rebellion afoot, a bit of a revolution. We're hearing of all kinds of different forms of education now. I saw a news release out of Maple Ridge where they're allowing, I believe, 60 students to become environmentally, the environment is their classroom. So they won't be in a classroom at all. They're going to spend all their time outside. This has been sanctioned by the local school board there. I went, okay, this is a very interesting situation. $1 million went to Simon Fraser University to monitor this experiment.
Well, they'll find that it's successful. I mean, I'm very much into environmental issues, been an environmental activist for many years. And, I taught my child those things by going to protests, reading stuff, being involved. We volunteered at various organizations that I'm a member of and all this kind of stuff. And, the schools can't do everything, and them trying to do everything is just setting themselves up for failure, setting the kids up for failure, and that's what's happening. I mean, and parents need to, realize this. I mean, we've been told all these things, the whole child. That is a great concept, and of course your child is a whole child, but the school can't do everything, and nobody can do everything. The parent is the one who's going to do the most.
We've seen the exodus. Homeschooling is just becoming accepted. People are increasingly moving in that direction. Technology nowadays, it gives us great ability to be creative in how we see the education of our children. Coming in to tonight, Ron and I were talking about, they keep kids in school too long. By the time you're 16, let me out of there, right? Let's go and work, those kinds of things. Let's funnel ourselves into something that's constructive. The waste of time is child abuse of what's happening in the classroom, at least my way of thinking.
Well, that's, the all-day kindergarten thing, there's a new study out sponsored by the Principals Association and authored by somebody who works with the Human Early Learning Partnership help, and finding, guess what, that it's a success.
Okay.
But even in that report, I didn't read the entire thing, but reading bits and pieces, it's like, yes, the children are very tired. Some are too tired. And it was all, they only studied self-selected teachers, a few that wanted to be part of the study. So if they're finding that kids are too tired, and then at the end of the day your kid comes home exhausted and just sort of fried, and you're not going to take that kid out to an event or a swimming lesson or a a walk in the park. They just need to sort of sit and relax and maybe sleep a lot longer. So it's going to erode your family time, because if you've got more than one kid, well, then you can't take, you know, go out for a family walk around the park or swim
Jane
or something.
Because Jane has to recuperate from her day at kindergarten.
Well, that's exactly what people are telling me. The kid's just too tired.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I read a lot of the news reports several months after all-day kindergarten was instituted into the schools and bullied into the schools
because
you didn't have a choice. If you want your funding, you have to do this, right? Mm-hmm. But one particular article about a teacher's perspective on this and how wonderful she loved it because it gave her more opportunity to integrate herself with the teaching community. It wasn't about the kids. It was all about her ability to hang with the other teachers.
Doesn't this study sound a lot like, you remember recently there was a study done on Insight, the safe injection site, which is now, I think, giving out crack
pipes.
Smoking pipes.
Yeah.
Anyway, but
do you have a problem with that, Ron Gray?
Well, the operation was studied by the people whose idea it was, and surprise, surprise, they said, "Oh, it's working wonderfully."
Yeah.
Well, all the studies that you used to push all day kindergarten, well, they don't use peer reviewed. Health doesn't publish peer reviewed items to back their programs that they're pushing, that the government is paying them to push.
This is what we want you to do. This is
literature.
Where we want to go, and this is what we'd like you to say,
and then we'll pay you. The government pays them to make the policy, design the policy, monitor the policy, collect the data, and promote the policy in the media, and write the research, and do all the advising. I mean, that is a conflict of interest.
To say the least. But,
yeah.
Okay, so let's go back to all-day kindergarten, because in my way of thinking, Helen, this was just a way, the idea of universally funded daycare was floated around several years before this, and people just said, don't even go there. Don't go there. You know, if people want to have children and if people want to work, then they better figure out a way to do that. So that was shot down. So then did we just masquerade this whole universal daycare as all-day kindergarten?
Exactly. That's
just
exactly what happened.
The name.
The OECD, with Canadian input from the daycare lobby here, published a study in 2006, I'm pretty sure it was 2006, recommending that they use all-day kindergarten as a bridge to a universal daycare program. It was right there in the report. So it's just changing the wording because they figured parents would be more accepting because it's through the education system. So that was, yes, it was deliberate daycare through the back door, exactly the same people pushing exactly the same agenda, coming down to you, not coming up from the grassroots, coming down from the World Bank and the OECD.
Yeah.
There's not child-friendly people.
All those people that want to take care of us.
The names have been changed to protect the guilty.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about UBC and the studies, because we've done a number of shows, and this continues to concern me. The fact that parents, and I was thinking when we were scheduling this show, I was thinking, you know, what we really need to do is have a warning guide, you know, for be aware when your child walks through those doors at the schools, these are the things you need to do. These are the things you need to watch for. These are the things you need to say no to. These are the things you need to be informed on and then say no to. But one of those is data collecting, because we see, and right after, I mean, you broke the news about the government using this to infiltrate families. Then we had Michael Vaughn on from the BC Civil Liberties Association that broadened the concern, because we have this new program called Citizens at the Center, where the government wants all of our data. Now,
all means all.
All means everything. Comprende, people. So we have little five-year-olds providing, you know, insight into their family units in kindergarten, typically without parental knowledge. They do send some information home on it, but you have to opt out, do you not?
Well, yeah, you're talking about the Early Development Instrument, the EDI. This is a 100 or so question questionnaire that kindergarten teachers fill out in February, and the parents are given a letter that doesn't explain. It mentions data linkage, doesn't explain the extent of that. I mean, they're looking at not just your child's all their medical information, all their school information, all their daycare information, and all their drug information, but yours as well, and your census data. They want to get your tax information. That's what's what they're seeking. That's Hertzman has said that. Clyde Hertzman from UBC has explained that in a report, Stats Canada, that this is all.
But that's illegal.
Well, everything that I'm talking about used to be illegal. They changed the laws. They said they wanted the tax data. They don't have it yet, but that's where they're aiming for. I mean, talking about your perinatal records. I mean, ladies, I mean, when you're pregnant, you know the things that you tell your doctor. I don't want.
That's confidential information.
Well, yeah, but it's all your perinatal records are not your property. The Human Early Learning Partnership has the database that links all these different things, also including WorkSafe BC.
And it's all for the interest of understanding the best needs of children. It's couched in these terms that people don't equate this equals this, right?
Oh, it's putting the citizens in the center.
Yeah.
Or in the crosshairs, if you will.
Yeah, in the crosshairs.
In the crosshairs, I think. Yeah, actually, we should use that one.
Well, the letter that parents get, like I say, it doesn't explain the depth of this data collection. It doesn't explain that this early development instrument, well, the teacher's going to be filling in things, ask questions like, is there problems at home? Does the child go to Sunday school or Hebrew school? Also, they're speculating. I mean, has the child been in daycare? How much was it? Was it daycare center? Was it public? They ask all these questions. So the teacher's just being asked to speculate. There is no hard data collected in the EDI, for example, a vocabulary test, because EDI is used to claim that, as Clyde Hertzman will tell you, over 30%, sometimes they say 25%, or over 30% of children are developmentally vulnerable or at risk. They use all sorts of different terms.
Well, that's to get our heartstrings pumping,
yeah,
right?
But they have pushed this thing. If you look in the media records on health, they push this 30% are not ready or vulnerable or whatever they're calling it, very heavily. It was quoted in all of the media, usually on the front page, repeatedly. It was like a mass media campaign. And so I check out the EDI home website. The EDI was created at McMaster University by the Offord Center. And they say 1 in 20 children, 5%.
5%.
1 in 20 children are not ready to learn in school at kindergarten age. And Hertzman is telling us that it's over 30%. There is a discrepancy. Like, Hertzman works closely with the person who had developed the EDI at Offord Center. So there is a disconnect there. And 1 in 20 kids not being ready, that makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. And the solution is, well, let them wait another year. And the kids who are most likely not to be ready are boys, ESL kids, and children born later in the year. Like, I have a son who's born in October.
And so this is where I go, duh.
Yeah. So it's, like, obvious. And even if they're not ready, is the solution to put them in a full, you know, all-day program at the age? I mean, they were shooting, like, for 3 to 5, kindergarten from ages 3 to 5, which would include 2-year-olds.
Yeah.
That is... there's no evidence on the planet that shows that a full kids that age spending that long in an institutional setting is good for them.
Well, quite
if they're
right.
Not, if
quite
they're not
one
ready,
to 22.
Put them in. What is that?
Yeah.
How
does
that fit?
When it doesn't make sense, does it? Yeah.
No.
Well,
but
isn't the evidence quite the contrary?
The evidence is the contrary. That especially if a child is like not ready, like, and especially boys and tend to be more not ready, starting at age. 6, like 72 months, is more likely to be in their interest. And, you know, the all-day kindergarten studies will show, like this one that they've just publicizing now, that they often show that there's some academic cognitive skill kind of gain at grade 1. Well, these all fade, so that by the grade 3 or so, the kids who've been in the institutional setting for longer are not better off academically or cognitively. And in the longer term, the very hard data, very excellent study by the National Institute for Child Health and Human Development in the U.S., gold standard kind of research, found that by age 15, children who spent more time in a group setting will have what they call more risk-taking behavior, which means more drugs, more sex, more violence, more suicide, and all those sorts of things.
So we're working against ourselves then as far as what kind of products we're bringing.
Well, when we have riots all over the world and you're wondering, well, what's changing with
let's
the kids?
Let's see, what's the common denominator?
You don't understand. This isn't for the children. It's for the early childhood education industry. They're just raw material.
Well, I think it's for the tax base. I mean, because the more people that you get involved in that industry, don't you, the more government money you have, the more problems you create. And ironically, you know, it goes to, and again, I'm reminded of our previous caller, you know, and your comment about, you know, needs marketing, creating industry, creating needs. Yeah. If we know it in 15 years, we're going to have problematic kids that are going to be rioting in the streets and police officers that aren't smart enough to know ahead of time that it's going to happen. You know, this creates a whole nother set of requirements for more workers, more government servants.
Well, the GDP grows. I mean, the riot was a bonus to our economy. Mm. You know, it's created a mini industry. And the riots in the UK, I mean, like a large minor industry.
We haven't yet begun to consider putting Prozac in the drinking water.
But, I mean, they brought in the program based on this one lie about the 30% being not ready or whatever they want to call it. And the other big lie, like Ministers Bond and McDermott, who are both the both Ministers of Education, they said that there's going to be economic benefit in long term from this spending of up to $17. Actually, McDermott even said unlimited economic benefit. That's based on HELP's telling them that a Nobel Prize-winning economist named James Heckman supports this and says these things. But Heckman says exactly the opposite. Heckman says there's no evidence for universal programs, and he recommends vouchers only for parents and, you know, very underprivileged families to use in not – he's against government programs. He wants to use in programs run by faith and community groups. That's what he calls
right.
them. And that there should be a variety of all kinds of different programs. He says, we don't know what kind of program is the most successful. We have all kinds of different kinds of programs competing and the parents making those
choices. I've got a program. Family.
Yeah.
You know, a novel concept.
Well, when he says program, he could mean that it's a – you know, maybe some kind of ESL class for the mom or something like that from a Latino, ghetto family or something like that. And it could be anything. It's not like he's not saying put them in an institution.
Helen Ward, are you suggesting that bureaucrats whose career might depend on expanding their department might actually lie about the information they give to the minister?
Well, I just know that Dr. Clyde Hertzman is... he's an extremely respected person in Canada and in BC, and so is Dr. Paul Kershaw. He's kind of number two man at HELP there. If they're directly quoting Dr. James Heckman, I mean, I Googled the quote.
Directly misquoting.
I Googled the quote, and then I read what Heckman's, the context of that quote, and it's like, okay, you're telling the government of BC and Canada, he said that the government of BC will save over $400 billion in the long run with their programs, and the Canadian government will save $3.1 trillion in long term with these kind of investments or spending. And they said that's Heckman supports this. They routinely quote James Heckman, Dr. Kevin Milligan, an economist at UBC.
They misquote him.
Yeah, well, they quote him totally out of context. Economist at UBC, Milligan, says that this is jaw-dropping, gross misrepresentation of Heckman's work. And that's what he said. I mean, you can talk to him yourself.
So. Actually, we would like to talk to him. Okay.
But, I mean, they're lying. I mean, it's like this, how come academics who are, I mean, if you're a politician, you're dependent on your experts and your advisors. You know, I mean, I can give them the benefit of the doubt because these people are very heavily credentialed and they come and they tell you this thing and they've got all their sightings. You can't read all these reports. You don't have time to all that. And they've been misled by Clyde Hertzman to endorse these. So maybe they're knowingly misleading people, but I mean, there's no way that Clyde Hertzman does not know that he's misleading the public.
Okay, let me go to total wow. Let's just move to the fact that we have all these little tired children. Now, we're all parents here. We know what it is to be a four-year-old or to have a four-year-old.
Oh, they start screaming. Oh, my God.
Well, you know what? I remember by the time Friday came, you know, even going to just half days three times a week, that was enough for my kids typically, right? Yeah, that was, you know, they were ready to come home and have a good nap. But I'm thinking of our claim that we always make about wanting to work in the best interest of children. You know, the Minister for Children and Families, when she sees the report of these tired children, which is a health hazard to them, mm-hmm. isn't there some responsibility for somebody to start saying, wait a minute, are we truly operating in the interest of children?
Well, so there's the report, and then there's the executive summary, and then there's the recommendations. Now, the minister will not read the entire report.
No.
Very, very unlikely. They will read an executive summary, and these are intentionally designed to not present the guts of the information. So they'll only read that everything's successful and everything's happy, and they won't probably ask, was this a peer-reviewed study? And I mean, the study itself says at the end of it, the very last paragraph or so, that it was the participants, the few teachers that were involved, were selected by principals who were on board, selected teachers, and it's not very many. I don't want to say how many because I know I'm not sure. It was a small number, and it even says that you can't really use this material to judge the success of the program. It says that in the report, last paragraph or so. So the minister's not going to see that. The Vancouver Sun's headline was all-day kindergarten success.
Yeah,
success. And but the study says itself, you
with
can't
a
use
cute
it to judge
little
success.
Red-headed girl.
A little girl.
Yeah.
The Principals Association website, because they sponsored this report, says that one of the purposes of the report was to support all the kindergarten. Like, if your purpose in doing a study is to support something, well, you've got a foregone conclusion going there.
Yeah, well, let's find out the truth about whether or not we're operating in the interest of children.
Well, an objective,
objective, what a concept that is, Helen.
I mean, it says that right in the report, that it's not objective, basically. It says that you've got biased, self-selected participants doing the study. I mean, but the minister's not going to hear that, or if they somehow manage to find that out, their advisors and their handlers are going to, well, they might find themselves not being the minister anymore. The education ministry's changed a rather large number of times.
The whole government forum right now, Helen, is just in shatters and tears. I mean, we haven't had a government that demonstrates true leadership in a very long time.
Well, the Ministry of Children and Families and the Ministry of Education work together on these, early learning so-called programs, and HELP is the one, the Human Early Learning Partnership, directed by Clive Hertzman, is the one running the show there, as far as I can tell. I mean, they're designing the policies and all the rest of it. And they're the ones who's been consistently there for the last 10 years.
Hmm.
With a high turnover of ministers.
Well, I suggest that we know we're going to have an election in 2013 now, so that gives people enough time to start finding people who will demonstrate leadership. Now, speaking about the Ministry of Children and Families working in cahoots with the Ministry of Education, we broke another very important story here. Your research was excellent on this, involving the Roots of Empathy program.
Mm, yeah.
A program that was Premier Clark made it sound all warm and fuzzy, that there's this baby that will come in and suddenly heartstrings will grow to magnificent lengths within each child. What she neglected to tell parents, which you found out, is that of the 27 visits of the Roots of Empathy program into your child's classroom, 9 of those are with the baby, but there's some
kind of facilitator, most likely a social worker or a counselor or somebody of that nature, according to their information, who's facilitating the empathy growth.
Well, and I watched quite a few of the videos associated with that program, and once again, it reminded me exactly of the data that they're trying to gather on kids, because they were talking about feelings. Like, the whole focus again is on feelings. And one of the books being written by or being read to the group in this promotional video has the founder of the Roots of Empathy talking about this father that looks so scary, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, this reminds me of programs in the past that they've used to get children to tell on their parents, mm-hmm. and those kinds of things. So this is a program, people, if your kids are in school, again, Roots of Empathy, put your antennas up on that, because it's the social workers and counselors and the feel-gooders are going to be in your child's classroom.
Well, parents need to know that your child can be taken out of a classroom at any time and interviewed by a social worker without your knowledge or consent. This happened
routinely.
A little girl that I know, she was 8 at the time, was taken out of the classroom, interviewed by a social worker, asked, does her mother take any medication? What kind of medication? About her household routines, her getting up, her eating, and all the rest of it. And the mother was informed later this had taken place. She was investigated by the social workers. She came out clean. They also called her doctor and asked her personal questions, and, you know, all these kinds of questions about her. And they asked, I was at the meeting with the social worker. They asked about, well, when does she get up? When does she go to bed? Da, 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 da. It's like, do we really have the ministry of it running, asking these kind of questions?
This is a girl, oh, we do.
In like a very healthy, vibrant girl, no bruises, no marks, no. The accusations were that, one, the child had been... her mother had raised her voice at the child in the playground to get her to go home. The child was late for school some days, and the mother had grabbed her roughly, not abusively, he clarified, by the wrist once. And none of those things are... He didn't say abuse or neglect or anything, so I thought, well, why are they investigating?
Hmm.
And then when her file was cleared, I asked them how long they keep the files. Guess how long they keep the files? 99 years. 99 years.
And not only that 8-year-old girl doesn't know now is because I've been helping families way too long now in the apprehension issues. Families that I helped 25 years ago, their children are now growing up and having children, but there's already a record. When they check into the hospital to have the baby, there is a flag that goes up. This child has received services in the past. Yeah. So this...
And all this data linkage will really make that much easier,
well,
right?
I mean, this is what we're seeing, Helen.
Received services.
Well, the information isn't always,
right?
accurate. Another family I know just helping out, they, the mother was told that the child was removed from the home, and it's like, child was never removed from the home. That's not what happened. And she clarified that with the social worker, but the social worker was like, no, the child was never removed from the home.
Hmm. Well, you know, the Freedom of Information Office claims that you can correct your files, but all of this information, good luck. I mean, we have tried, we've had courts order social workers to change files. It doesn't happen, people. So, again, when your child goes into school this year, every person, every parent should be aware that the Ministry of Children and Families believes it has the right to go into your child's school, ask your child to be withdrawn from a class, can interview the child. Now, I also say to parents that, you know, if social workers come to your home, you know, you have a right to refuse them entry. They can go get a warrant.
Okay, you need to tell people that because I've tried to find that out and I couldn't find that.
Yeah.
Because they could basically come and take your kid without a warrant if they...
Well, you know, the statute... Well, you have to be pretty tough about it, right? Mm-hmm. The statute clearly states that if access to a child is denied... Okay, then they have to go get a warrant. But, you know, it's interesting because years ago, you probably are aware of this, Helen, back way in 1991, I believe, I worked very closely with the Ombudsman's Office of the day, and he made recommendations for legislative change. And one of those recommendations he was very clear on is that there shouldn't be any apprehensions without a warrant. A social mm-hmm. worker should have to go into court and say, this is the evidence mm-hmm. I have, mm-hmm. it's valid, I can prove it, and then have the ability to go and remove a child. Criminals have more rights than parents
do. Well, they can investigate you because your child was late for school and you raised your voice and you grabbed the child somewhat roughly by the wrist, I mean, what parent's going to stand? You know, I mean, they're investigating that. They also investigate people for homeschooling. I've been at, you know, a meeting. It's like, and I kept saying to the social worker, well, homeschooling is not against the law. You haven't accused the parent of any kind of abuse or neglect. So why are we here?
Mm-hmm.
Why are we here? Why are we wasting, like, you know, hundreds and hundreds of dollars for just for one meeting?
Well, and I tell this story often, too, and this relates, obviously, to what goes on in the public education system, too. Parents, if there is a child abuse prevention program in your school, and it won't be called that, what they'll say is, oh, this is a child safety program, okay? Please go to the school, look at the program, okay? And if it's anti family, anti-father, anti-grandfather, those kinds of things. No, you're going to have problems. The one program I'm referring to, of course, is the CARE program. And this told little five-year-olds on a repetitive basis that the people most likely to harm them were their fathers and their grandfathers. They gave those examples. Now, sure, we want to help the one or two children in a thousand that might be in that situation. Regrettably, what you do is you destroy the relationship that the other 999 have, okay? Plus, there's other better ways of helping children. But the interesting part about this, and this happened to a friend of mine, actually this is how what led into my way too long work now in apprehension. Her daughter reported her father for changing her diapers when she was two. And one of the claims that, because they said, okay, here, and I had another client, because the same program says, if anyone touches you in the area under a one-piece bathing suit, that's abuse. And who do you report this to? The teacher. Okay, because the teacher's the savior in all of this. Mm-hmm. Well, excuse me, people, I just got the BC College of Teachers report on how many sexual perverts we have teaching in British Columbia, how many of these teachers are accessing porn on their school computers. The teacher is not the savior for most children. But the social workers came out because of the complaint about the one-piece bathing suit. And I said, okay, this is, you know, any sensible person, any sensible read of this material and any simple understanding of how children's minds would work, you could see how a child could be very easily confused. As a matter of fact, the child wasn't confused. The child did exactly what the program said. My daddy tickled me on the tummy. The tummy is under the one-piece bathing suit. My daddy did that. Boom. Social workers are called in. I called the School of Social Work after we rescued the family, and I said, look, what the heck are you teaching, you know, your workers about this program? Well, what do you mean, Ms. Simpson? I said, well, come on, you know, if you are familiar with this program, you could see how easily children are confused. Oh, but Ms. Simpson, if a child's reporting that their father tickled them, there's probably way more to the story. Children don't disclose everything the first time we talk to them. No, they have to wait till they're led into further disclosure. So, again, people...
Wait until false memories are implanted.
There
yes.
you go. Yeah. Again, so please know what's going on in your child's classroom. These programs sound so wonderful. And in this particular program, the CARE program, any teacher would have admitted that this is not a prevention program. It was a disclosure program. Teachers were told to lie to parents about this and the real purpose. And because their hearts were in the right place, they wanted to save children. They were basically told they could be a child saver. You know, they went along with it. Wrong. You need to know what's going on in your classroom.
Yeah. The other option is to not go to the classroom.
Well, and a lot of people are opting for that option these days.
Yeah, there's, I mean, the statistics on homeschooling don't really give an accurate picture because most people who call themselves homeschoolers aren't listed as homeschoolers by the statistics because they are actually enrolled in some kind of program in a public or independent school, but they don't attend a school classroom.
Mm-hmm.
These are a lot of the programs are called DL, distributed learning programs. These are done mainly online through the computer, and you have some connection with a teacher. There's a huge variety of them. There's ones that are run out of public schools and ones that are out of independent schools. That's one option. The other option is to be a pure homeschooler where you're not enrolled in any program. You're just registered. And BC has probably the best home learning regulations on the planet. The only requirement is that a child be registered with a public or independent school and that the child be provided with an education program. But education program is not defined in the School Act, so you can define it yourself. You don't have to do any tests or any whatever. You can do what you want. Or you could do one of these DL programs, or even take a few courses through a DL program, or I'll do the whole package if you want, or mix and match from independent and public schools.
And the schools are quite helpful. I know the private schools bend over backwards to accommodate, so if you want your child involved on a sports team or involved in a PE program, those kinds of things, the schools will usually allow the homeschool students to come in and participate on those teams.
I mean, parents got to know that your kid's butt is worth an average of $8,300 per, you know, that's the funding that the public schools get per child, is an average of $8,300. It varies from district to district. So if your kid's enrolled on their files, that's money for them. And so they're, you know, it's becoming more of a buyer's market, you could say, because not entirely, but, you know, if you decide that you want to, you know, enroll your kid in this other program or you're thinking about it, or then they want you and somebody else wants you, so they want to give you what you want. So if you want to send your kid, you want your kid to go to school, but you think the kid's got behavioral problems or whatever kind of problems, or you just want to spend more time with the family, so you're going to send them just on Monday, Wednesday, Friday. One of my friends doing that. They go to a public school Monday, Wednesday, Friday. School gets full funding.
Hmm.
Actually, one of the kids get double funding because the kid's somehow designated special needs, always sort of a regular kid. So Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and then the moms are doing the hardcore academic slogging with the kids. You know,
because schools aren't doing it.
Well, so I mean, you as a parent have a lot more power. If you tell the teachers, you know, or the school, I'm sorry, but Johnny's just going to go Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or whatever, or we're not going to do PE because we don't like PE, or whatever. I mean, you are in charge, and they're not going to tell you these things. Most schools don't actually, you know, cough up this information, but it's home learners find these things out, and you can do these things.
That's really good to know.
Yeah, but you know, you hit the nail on the head. We wield as parents a lot of power, especially if we've got that $8,300 bargaining chip, right?
Yeah.
And the schools are feeling the pinch nowadays because there has been an exodus out of the public education mm-hmm. system. If a child's not enrolled full time, they're not going to get that full funding. Their budgets are dependent on that, and
right.
This is where.
Small clarification. My understanding is that it's grades 10 to 12 that you could do like a half-time thing,
mm-hmm.
but under that you can't mix and match. That's my understanding.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But the other aspect to this, and I think this is where the evolution of the whole homeschool movement has happened to, is within our universities, because there was a time, probably 15 years ago, that everybody was a little bit leery, but now they're finding that these kids are the best students
the
going.
The universities
yeah.
are actively trying to recruit homeschooled students.
Well, yeah. The other thing is, like, suppose your kid totally wipes out academically at whatever kind of, you know, program you're doing, you know, does not get his or her, you know, grade 12 certificate thing. The worst thing that can happen is that they won't be eligible for university or post-secondary until a year later, when they can enter as a mature student with no graduation certificate whatsoever. Then they'll just take them, doesn't matter how bad your grades were or weren't, you can go that way.
Hmm.
So there's, I mean, it's a pressure that we felt historically that, you know, we got to get this high mark because we've got to get in there and all that kind of stuff. It's like the universities, there's way more of them than there used to be. They also want your bum in the seat because it's worth money to them. The standards have dropped through the floor. All the testing requirements, they're falling through the floor. You can get somebody to talk to you about that. I mean, like, you know, if you want to do that, you can do
but,
that.
But you know what? This is, I think, the problem. And I don't know why, but flashing into my mind is the 19 Ferraris, Mercedes, and BMWs. You know, we'd rather
that?
Be driving than getting educated, you know. But,
and where did they get the money to buy a Maserati?
Oh, they didn't own them. No.
This
is mommy and daddy, you know. The spare car, you know.
Mommy and daddy probably aren't in the country. They're probably abroad.
Yeah, but we don't know because they won't release the names or the owners of the vehicles. For some reason, we need to be shielded from that information, mm-hmm. which I think is a whole other subject matter. Helen, the standards within the schools, within the universities, you know, again, we're back to these make-work projects. Some of the faculties that we now see being developed in the universities, the substandards, the queer studies, the women's studies, the We Demand conferences.
Yeah.
You know, is this a whole industry that sort of needs to be exposed at this point? I mean, this is costing us money.
This is like Ivan Illich is one of my gurus, I guess. He's passed away now, but he put a book out in the 70s called De-Schooling Society. And what a key concept in that book was, like, I mean, sure, have schools. People want to go to them. That's fine. I have tests and things. People want to do them. But it's a certification thing. It's like you used to be able to do all kinds of jobs without a certificate. Now mm-hmm. these jobs require a certificate and sometimes 2 to 4 years or more of, you know, studies and certification. So it's like that's an industry, is a certification industry. Like now,
well, let me give you one perfect example, because we're running out of time, but I predicted this years ago, because in order to take care of children in this province, you are prohibited if you have two or more children in your care that are not related by blood or marriage. I mean, typically you're breaking the law if you have a birthday party, quite honestly. If you're providing supervision for two or more children not related by blood or marriage, you are breaking the law.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And we actually had daycare centers being shut down, good family-run daycare centers. And this turned into an industry. Okay, so then you needed to be licensed by the province, okay? And that was fine. You could be just an ordinary mom, and you could go get your license, and you could have six kids, right? But then we saw that you needed an early childhood education certificate, and that meant two or four years in school.
Well, but then you got like a 21-year-old looking after, you know, in Quebec, up to five babies, one staff of five babies. In BC, it's four babies. And like I'm not qualified to do that. I mean, I wouldn't even attempt that. It's immoral.
So but we've created a whole new university program mm-hmm. that requires people and our funding to facilitate this. So anyway, the time went by way too fast. Kids First, how can people get a hold of you?
www.kidsfirstcanada.org.
And you guys are there.
Well, let's slow that down.
www.kidsfirstcanada.org.
Kidsfirstcanada.org.
Yeah, email info@kidsfirstcanada.org.
And you know what, people? If anything happens in your school that your antennas go up and you think, well, Helen or Carrie or Ron should know about this, you know, send us an email. Make sure we know, because we do depend on all of your eyes and ears out there and in the corridors of higher learning to let us know what's really going on.
And remember this, the most important thing in raising kids is love, and no one is going to love your kids like you do.
Yeah.
No one.
Helen Ward, always good to see you. I'm sure you will be back often.
Okay.
Keep us on our toes. Keep us informed. Ron Gray, as always, it's so good to see you, and we will be doing this more often because our Terry O'Neill has flown the coop for a little while. We did not get to everything we wanted to, so next week you'll have to tune in, people. And until then, enjoy your week. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everyone.
You've been listening to Roadkill Radio. Join us again next week for another trip down the superhighway of information, fact, and truth.